We're going to read together this evening in the book of Psalms, the Psalm number 53. The Psalm number 53. As we turn to God's Word, let me leave with you a couple of special requests for prayer, which I trust you will take with you to the throne of grace this evening. I'd like you to remember our sister Holly Staten, who had to go to the emergency room a couple of nights ago and was kept in hospital and underwent surgery this afternoon. She had a gallbladder operation. The gallbladder has been removed. And though she was very groggy, she did speak with Mary just before the service. And the surgeon said they found 200 stones in her gallbladder. It's not much wonder she was suffering intense agony over protracted periods of time in recent days. So she is through the surgery. She has something in the region of another week in hospital, and then a 6-week period of recuperation. The Lord has worked out things very well. Tim's folks happened to be in town visiting them when all this really came to a head, and so they're still at the home looking after the newborn baby, and I think it's been a great encouragement and testimony to them just exactly how the Lord undertakes and is especially undertaking for their family at this time. Them, I think it's Tim's sister, will be in town through the summer with them, and she'll be able to bear the brunt of the responsibility of looking after the baby and running the home while Holly recuperates. So do keep the Statons much in your prayers at this time. We'd also like you to continue to be in prayer for Danny Voss. Danny is now back home after his hospitalization. He has suffered a tremendous loss of weight. He's about 30 pounds lighter than he was, very much weakened, obviously. I don't think that he'll ever really appreciate how near to death he was, and only the goodness of the Lord has carried him through to this time. Danny needs your prayers for a speedy recovery. I think also he needs your prayers that the Lord's hand will be upon him in a very real way spiritually. He will speak of the Lord, at least when I have been there to visit him, he will speak of the Lord, but has yet fallen short of a very clear testimony that he is truly trusting Christ and living for Christ. He has what I think is too often and too glibly called an attitude problem. I always think an attitude problem goes a lot deeper than attitudes. And it's very easy to be critical. Danny is a young boy who's constantly in pain since this accident. And even without the accident, he's constantly feeling very subpar because of an extreme case of diabetes. And when you're feeling bad fairly continually, it's difficult to keep a sweet spirit and to be smiling to people when they feel you ought to be smiling because they feel like smiling. It's very difficult, especially in a young person who wants to be doing a lot of things that he maybe feels he now cannot do. But the Lord has a purpose in all these things, and I trust that you'll keep Danny much before the Lord, that his grace will be very evident in his life at this time. Do pray for Sam and for Mary. We ask you please to continue to pray for them. Their own health has suffered through this entire experience. Our brother Sam, one of our elders here, is certainly not in good physical shape. And sometimes it's very grieving just to see how weakened he has become, and to see him reduced many times just to hobbling. And yet in spite of it all, he does maintain a very sweet temper and walks with God. But we need Sam in the ministry here. He's a very quiet man. Many of you may not know just how much before the Lord we depend upon him. And in our session and committee meetings, we appreciate him. There's one thing we appreciate him for, and I know that all the session members and committee members will take this much to heart. We would never get closed if it weren't for Sam. If you look at our records, you'll find that the motion to adjourn the meeting is always in Sam's name. So much so it's become part of our heritage, practically. And if Sam can't be there, Dr. Gingery will move in the name of Sam Voss. But we do love him in the Lord, and we appreciate all that he's been doing for us as a church. We trust that you will be praying for him, that God's hand will be upon him and touch him physically at this time. Now we're going to read this 53rd Psalm. Verse 1. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. Corrupt are they, and have done abominable iniquity. There is none that doeth good. God looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand, that did seek God. Every one of them is gone back. They are altogether become filthy. There is none that doeth good. No, not one. Have the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread? They have not called upon God. There were they in great fear, where no fear was. For God hath scattered the bones of him that encampeth against thee. Thou hast put them to shame, because God hath despised them. Oh, that the salvation of Israel were come out of Zion. When God bringeth back the captivity of his people, Jacob shall rejoice, and Israel shall be glad. Amen. The Lord will add his own blessing to these verses from his own precious word for his name's sake. The Lord must have thought that the message of this psalm is a message that we need to have ingrained upon our consciousness, a message that we would be slow to learn, and in many cases, unwilling to learn. I say that because this psalm appears almost, though not quite, word for word, in two parts of the Psalter. You have it first in the 14th Psalm, and again here in the 53rd Psalm. There are slight verbal differences, and though they are slight as to their verbal form, they are not without significance, though I'm not going to try to enter into that study tonight. The similarity is so great that great commentators like Calvin and Hengstenberg and others, when they come to the 53rd Psalm, simply refer their readers back to their comments on the 14th Psalm. So to all intents and purposes, we have a psalm here that is given us on two occasions. Now, two is the number of witness. It's in the mouth of two or three witnesses that every word will be established. And here we have a divine witness to a very solemn and searching theme. I have said it's a message which we need to learn, and a message which mostly we are unwilling to learn. It is the divine view of human nature, and especially as that truth has an effect upon the people of God in their service for Jesus Christ in this world. The first four verses of Psalm 53 describe for us the environment of the believer, the environment in which he serves. It is an environment of depravity, which presents the Christian with grave difficulties in his work for the Lord. You will notice in the heading of the psalm that it says, to the chief musician upon Mahalath, Maskil, a psalm of David. This is the first time in the psalms that the word Mahalath appears. It is a word that is connected with the thought of diseases or disease of the body. I think that that's a very, very instructive heading, therefore, to this psalm. Because I agree with all those commentators who tell us that this is a psalm that sets out in a peculiar way to discover for us the innate disease of humanity. Here we have God uncovering the spiritual disease of fallen mankind. And what a statement of human depravity is here given to us. The fool hath said in his heart. It's interesting that when men describe themselves, especially in an age like ours, when they have progressed so far in scientific endeavor that they feel they can now say there is no God, they describe themselves in glowing terms. God says they are fools. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. Some people have said, you'll notice that the words there is are italicized and therefore do not appear in the original. We are therefore to understand this as a wish that the fool says no God in the sense of wishing there were no God. Or the fool says no in quotes, to God. Well, all those things may be very true, but the Authorized Version has it right. The form of the original means that God is a non-existence. He doesn't enter into it. And here you have the root of the depravity which is cursing this country today. God is a non-existence. He just doesn't count. Men allow for religion, but a religion other than the worship of God as he has revealed himself is nothing more or less than a man making himself his own idol and worshiping himself or the projections of his own intellect. That's idolatry. The fool hath done that. The fool has said, there is no God. You will notice the immediate result of a rebellion against God as he is revealed. Corrupt are they. And in this day and age in which men proudly present their glorious endeavors in various fields as proof that there is no God, as Khrushchev once said, we have sent men many miles into space and we have not found God. That doesn't in any way surprise me. When God came in the flesh, in the person of Jesus Christ, and confronted men, they were still so blind that they could not say they had seen or found God. So when a communist, like Mr. Khrushchev, well, he's not a communist or a Marxist or an atheist any longer. Of that you can be certain. But when one of his mind says, we have gone way out there and we have found no God, I'm not a little bit surprised. But that kind of notion is now widespread. Because science hasn't found God at the end of a scientific experiment. Because they can't produce him from a test tube. Because they can't train their microscopes and find that he's so small they've got to magnify him. Or gaze away through their telescopes into space and find his hiding place. Because they can't do it, there is no God. What's the result of it? Corrupt are they. Men do not disbelieve in God because the weight of the evidence is so strong. Men disbelieve in God because they're corrupt and they love their sin. That's the real reason. No man can become an atheist by the weight of the evidence. Now, of course, don't misunderstand me. A man can profess there's no God because of his study of evidence, because he starts out saying, in effect, I'm God. That's what he does. What I think, my mind is the final court of appeal. A great American theologian, my opinion, the greatest American, well, he was a Dutchman who became a naturalized American, the greatest theological thinker in this country of this century. I'm not going to pursue his theology tonight, mind you. When we do this in the theological hall, the fellows feel that they are going through the tribulation. They have certainly solved all eschatological problems. The church will be in the tribulation because they're in it already. But he said a man cannot even say there is no God except on the ground that God is. There's a profundity in that that you would do well to consider. The fool says there's no God. Why? Because they're corrupt in heart. They have done abominable iniquity. There's none that doeth good. The fall in the Garden of Eden was essentially a declaration of the non-existence of God as God. It was the declaration of a creature to total equality of authority and action with God. And ever since that, the result has been corruption and abomination. Is it therefore to be wondered at, in this day and age of professed atheism, that you have filth of unmentionable descriptions openly paraded in the streets? Is it to be wondered at that the television companies have sold out to the devil and to hell, and they infest and infect the homes of America with the foulest things that abominable and corrupt minds are capable of producing? It's not to be wondered at. Atheism will never produce the utopia that man longs for. It will never produce anything but the nearest possible thing to hell on earth. It may be missing something of the fires of hell, but it certainly will not be missing the foulness of hell. And it's interesting in this regard that the New Testament uses exactly the same phrase to describe the darkness of the human mind as it does to describe the darkness of hell itself. Far-reaching truth. Now, this is God's statement. It's not a statement of the worst of men in the worst of times. It's a statement of all men without grace at all times. God looked down from heaven. A tremendous encouragement for a believer in that. God is still on the throne. Nobody has replaced him. And thank God nobody will ever dethrone him. He looked down from heaven And he still looks down from heaven. He'll have the last say in all that is to be done in this old globe of ours. He looks down from heaven. To see if there were any that did understand that did seek God. Now look at verse 3. Every one of them has gone back. Here's one of the differences, if my memory is not too far removed from fact at the moment, from Psalm 14. Psalm 14, every one of them's turned back. He's gone back. This one. Psalm 53, everyone has gone back. Psalm 14, they have turned out of the way. To turn out of the way is tragic. But this is an even stronger thing. They have gone back from God. They are altogether become filthy. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. You remember Paul quoted that in the third chapter of Romans to prove the universality of sin. Now I want you to get what the Lord is saying here. I want you to get this. This is the environment in which you and I are called to serve God. I don't want to get too theological tonight, nor do I want to get too controversial tonight. I said this was a message that many of us are unwilling to learn. You know that most preachers, most Bible-believing, separated, fundamental preachers don't want to believe that message, and they don't believe it. That's a big statement. It's very easily established. Is a sinner really dead in sin? Well, yes, he's dead, if you understand the word dead to mean something less than dead. Is a sinner really dead? Well, no, he is not personally dead. He's just in the sphere of death. I have never been able to work that one out, to be quite honest. And I'm giving you there a verbatim quotation. But I've never really been able to work that one out. I have heard preachers preach that he is dead, all except his will. And if only he would, then he could. Well, obviously, if only he would, he could. That's the whole trouble. He won't. And I don't say that as a future tense. I say that as an expression of his will. Jesus said in John 5 and verse 40, to unsaved men, ye will not come to me. That's not a future of the verb to come. That is a statement, ye have no will to come to me, that ye might have life. Now let's get this. They are all corrupt. They're all engaged in abominable things. There's none that understands or seeks God. They've all become filthy. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Now that's the environment in which we live. I want you to see this tonight. Because if you and I are going to serve God successfully, we have got to recognize that the work of God is carried on by the work, by the moving of the Spirit of God, by God interposing His power in a situation where man is altogether anti-God, anti-Christ, sold out to sin and sold out to the devil. Now, there's not a thing you can do about changing that nature. You can give information to a sinner, he'll just go to hell, a better educated sinner. There are preachers who believe that all a sinner needs is more information. Give him the information, and he has the innate ability to respond. I heard a preacher on radio, not terribly long ago, berating, I think he may have been berating me actually, but I enjoyed that. But berating the position that I'm stating tonight. And saying, you know, it's crazy, these people who are saying that the sinner has no faculty to respond. I never said that. I believe a sinner responds every time he hears the gospel. Trouble with a sinner is he has only one way that a fallen will responds. And that's the way God states here.
And I have got to recognize there's not a thing I can do about that. I can give that man all the information in the world, all the information in the Bible. Unless God quickens a dead soul, there's never going to be life. Here's the environment in which we work. That's why we're here to pray tonight. It is not a coincidence that the decline of the prayer meeting has gone hand in hand with the reinstatement of what is known in historical theology as Pelagian and semi-Pelagian theology. That is, that man has the innate ability to seek God. And the more the church has come to believe that, the less it has prayed, and the more it has concentrated on methods to produce a psychological effect upon men. It's not coincidental. It is purely cause and effect. We are here to pray because we recognize that though men have the responsibility to obey the gospel, yet their will, with every other faculty of soul, is utterly depraved. Willingly they are slaves to the devil and to sin. And unless we can take Ephesians 2 and 4 and write it over their lives, but God, who is rich in mercy, quicken them. Unless we can say, but God entered in and did something, then we're never going to see any of them saved. That's why we pray. God is able to save. Let's get that. Salvation is of the Lord. It's not of man. It's of the Lord. And that encourages me. That seems to discourage so many people. You mean to say I have no part in it? Then I'll never be saved. Man, that's the most contorted thinking that I can imagine. If it's of the Lord, I'm delighted. Because there are so many things that I can't do. I'm glad to say He can do it. He can save. Now let's get confidence in this tonight. You look at the city of Greenville. As our people go from door to door, the one thing that comes through more than any other is that this is a city where there are countless numbers of people who say, oh yes, yes, I'm a Christian. They have a decision. And they haven't another thing in the world. They don't want to be probed about it. Don't want to look at their basis of belief that they're going to heaven. Lost sinners told by the church that they're going to heaven. That is the hardest type of sinner to reach. But you see, salvation's of the Lord. He's able to save. He's absolutely able to save. And He will. The workers of iniquity, verse 1, they're fools. In verse 4, they have no knowledge. They eat up my people as bread. They thrive on opposing the people of God. This is the environment. This is the depravity that poses grave difficulty to us in the work of God. They thrive in this. But have they no knowledge? Mr. Spurgeon made some comments in this text when he said, have they no knowledge? Are they fools altogether? Do they not realize that that diet that they're eating will cause them a most wretched vomiting, and God will cause them to pay for all their opposition?
to the cause of Jesus Christ. Now, this is our environment. But what is our expectation? Verse 5. There were they in great fear, or as it is literally, they feared a great fear, where no fear or no cause, no visible cause of fear was. It's like Proverbs 28:1. The wicked fleeth when no man pursueth. And the Lord promised that he would do this to sinners back in the book of Leviticus. And 26:17, he promised he would do this. Now notice this. There was no visible means to cause them to fear. But they were afraid. Why? Because God started to move against them. Now there are two ways that I would take this. First of all, in the purely natural way, the way that the Israelites enjoyed this psalm, that is the utter dispersal of the forces that are against the church of Jesus Christ. God can put fear in them. God can scatter them. And those hosts that are against us, that appear to be thwarting every endeavor to forward the work of God, those hosts can be brought to nothing overnight. God is able. That's what he does in revival. I believe in revival. Tell you there's no hope for this country or any other country unless God does send revival. But he's able. And it's a great study when you're looking at revival. We are always so much taken up with the main scene. Revival reminds me of a great play. Not that it's not for real, mind you, but it reminds me of a great play. I should get Dave Mook or Bill Pinkston to come and lecture you on this now. But if you study a great Shakespearean production, you'll find that there is the main plot. And people like myself who know no better, we read that or watch that, we're completely taken up with that main plot. But to those who have eyes to see it, there may be 100 little plots and characterizations and things of immense significance. That's the way it is in revival. We see in revival the building of great churches, the salvation of thousands and even hundreds of thousands of souls. And obviously, that's the center of the whole thing. We rejoice to see that. But there's another aspect. And I would commend it to your study. There's never been a revival, but that it has been the blast of God against particular forms of apostasy and the enmity that the devil has reared against the cause of Christ. I can speak with more authority, obviously, about what happened in my part of the world than in yours. When the 1859 revival hit Northern Ireland, you know, the Presbyterian Church was split down the middle. And the Unitarians were just as strong numerically. They felt actually they were stronger intellectually, theologically, in every other way. But at least numerically, they were just as strong as the main Presbyterian Orthodox body. In 1829, the greatest Presbyterian we have ever seen in our country, Dr. Henry Cook, I would certainly advise you to get his book checked out of the library and have a good look at Porter's Life of Henry Cook. I don't think it's the most thrillingly written book. I think Henry Cook deserves better. But nonetheless, it will give you a good insight into a great man. Henry Cook forced a division, and he forced these apostates out of the denomination. They formed their own body, and there they were, a great threat to the work of God. In 1840, two branches of Orthodox Presbyterianism came together, and they formed the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. Robert Murray McSheehan was one of the special visitors at that first General Assembly. It shows you the kind of meeting it was when they had men like McSheehan there. And Henry Cook was the first moderator. 19 years later, God visited that church. He visited others, but that was the main vehicle with the greatest revival that Ireland has ever seen. In 1 year, in a little place like Northern Ireland, with you look at it on a map and you'll find that it wouldn't make more than a couple of decent-sized counties here in the United States. And yet, in 1 year, more than 100,000 people were gloriously saved. But you know what happened? To use the words, I think the immortal words of S.B. Cook when he and I were preaching together at a big rally back home in 1966. I'll never forget how he described that period. And he described the demise of Unitarianism. He said, through that revival, it withered like the dirty weed it was. That's exactly what happened. Now you'll still find a couple of Unitarian churches. They're maintained by the gifts of a few rich men. They have one or two, especially in Belfast, of one very historic building. But that's all. Finished. How? By the power of God and revival. Now God can do that. You look at the things that are causing the biggest trouble to the work of Jesus Christ here in the United States today. What's the answer? Revival. That's the answer. Revival for the glory of God and for the removal of those enemies of God, which are going to exert every energy to stop God's work. That's the natural way to take this. But there is a spiritual interpretation or application. You know, I have talked about the environment, the dead souls who hate the gospel and rebel against Jesus Christ by nature. But you know, God can put them in the fear of conviction of sin. Do you ever see a soul, when God really gave him a dose of old time conviction? I can think of people tonight who were as hard as nails. Yet for no visible reason, they trembled like a leaf that was caught in a gale. Just trembled. I've seen people broken, but they just wept convulsively. God could put them in fear. Here, my friend, is our expectation. Here's the victory that really presents us with a glorious certainty. God is going to do this. He's going to do it. He's going to do it in judgment, certainly. But thank God he can even do it in grace. I long for the day in this church when there will be conviction like our forefathers knew in the days of revival. There's a brazenness abroad today that alarms me. Even among God's people, we have lost much of the heart, much of the tenderness. We've forgotten how to pray with tears. We can snore our way through a prayer meeting. But how few of us ever can weep our way to the throne of grace. I am deeply, deeply alarmed about the families in this church and in this city. We have young people. Dr. Barrett put it very well in a sermon he preached about a year or so ago. He said they were programmed for destruction. Computerized, like educated, automated beings, to give the right answers at the right times. They know the vocabulary of Zion.
They have a brazenness, heartlessness to the things of God. God needs to break them. I long for the day when there be conviction in our meetings. And I know full well that my preaching will not produce it. By the grace of God, I'll preach what needs to be preached as the Lord enables. But only God can touch the heart to break them, to cause them that fear, to bring them to Himself, to bring them to the depths of seeing their shame. That's what we need. He's going to do that. Do you notice that all this is tied in at the end of verse 6 with the captivity of the people of God, the bondage? Now, God's going to bring back our captivity. Some people are not very certain about that. It has become a mark of orthodoxy, even among some Bible believers, to believe that there cannot possibly ever be a revival again. I was told, I didn't get to hear this myself, but I was told of a great sermon that Dr. Bob Sr. preached just the other day on radio, in which he was making the very point I'm making now of the need for revival and the possibility of revival and his expectation of revival. That's the truth, you know. That's the truth. He has never yet brought a day in the history of his people, from the Old Testament times right through until this present, God has never yet brought a day wherein there has been a captivity that's irreversible. Do you think of that? Never. Don't you think that this is the first time that God's going to do that? Because according to this Bible, you know, Jesus Christ is not coming back for a church and a bride that's sullied and spoiled and worldly and defeated and away in Babylon. He's not coming for a church like that. Oh, he's coming for a church hated by the world, a church under intense persecution, but a church that will be in revival. That's the church he's coming back for. And you should remember this. I'm not going to get into all the fine points of eschatology, but whatever your eschatology, you remember this. That the next great opening of the heavens to declare the fullness of the redemptive plan and purpose of God when the two witnesses walk this earth will be a time when God again supernaturally stamps His power upon the world. And such will be the success that Revelation chapter 7 tells us, that the number of those saved defies computation. That's the church that Christ is coming back for. He's going to bring back our captivity. What's the biggest hindrance today in the work of God? Is it the environment? Well, I've talked about that, but God is able. I want to tell you the biggest hindrance in the church of Jesus Christ is you and me. That's what it is. It's the bondage of the people of God. Many of the Jews, when they went to Babylon, you know, they weren't really too desirous of getting out. There's a paradox here. When they were taken into Babylon, they went with weeping. When they were there at first, they stayed with weeping. But then they began to get prosperous. And when the time came, when King Cyrus said, "Who is among you that's willing to go up and build?" It was just a paltry number. Paltry number. And such was the dearth that the Levites were practically totally unrepresented. And Ezra had to go and make special arrangements to have some men flushed out of their holes in Babylon and brought to this work. Is that not a spiritual commentary on the position of the people of God? There was a time when the church mourned over the worldliness, but now it has become enshrined in our very churches.
Reggie was telling me today of having been in services.
Just as soon as the sermon was over and the benediction was pronounced, just immediately the Christians would turn one to another and say, "Where are we going to eat? Wonder what the score in the ball game is." As if now we have got the interruption out of the way, we can really get on with the things that matter. Bondage. In bondage to the world. Oh, that God would turn it back.
For this is the expectation of the believer. You'll notice it. Or the eagerness, really, of the believer. Oh, that the salvation of Israel were come out of Zion. Here's his eagerness. You see, a Christian can't walk with God and lightly look upon the situation that we're in today. Can't do it. If you can settle down in this world as it is now, well, number one, you've got to consider if you're really saved. If you're saved, man, you're far from God, backslidden and in bondage. No Christian can walk with God and have a view to the glory of God without praying this prayer. Actually, this verse in the original is a question. It's not the expression really of a desire except indirectly. And the question is, who will give out of Zion the salvations of Israel? The plural there is a plural, I think, of emphasis. Salvations emphasizing the multifaceted aspects of the work of God. He's going to give us a total work to meet every need. But who's going to do that? Now, it must come out of Zion. If you want to understand the full meaning of Zion, you should study carefully the 87th Psalm, which is a psalm about Zion itself. But it must come out of Zion. That's the only hope. To hear some Christians, you'd think our greatest hope was the White House. The Lord help your wit if you think that the White House is your great hope. Because it's like the whited sepulchres. It's only white in name and by appearance. There's no hope there. Now, I wish your president well. Pray God's blessing upon him, as the Scripture enjoins. And I wish him success in every endeavor against the leftists and the liberals. And I'm not going to get into criticizing his record and his flirtation with the Vatican. I'm not going to get into that at all tonight. That'll surprise some of you. But were he the godliest man who had ever stepped into that office, that still wouldn't be your answer. Must come out of Zion. Must be God working. Who's going to do it? The psalmist asks the question and he answers it. When God turned back our captivity. Only the Lord can do it. So I end on the same note that I struck right at the beginning. That's why we're here to pray. If only God can do it, then let's go and ask the Lord to do it. Does God answer prayer? Well, he says he does. If he doesn't answer prayer, not one of us saved, because you've prayed, and if God doesn't answer prayer, then you're still not saved. But if he does answer prayer, you're saved when you called upon the Lord, then with the very same faith you can now come to the Lord and say, "Lord, here's the situation. Now move. Now hear. Now answer prayer."